I mean, what's Pro Football Focus doing? Last week they had Brady. This week they got Brady.
We're doing it. We're literally doing it differently from everybody else.
As a matter of fact, moving forward from this point on, I will not make reference to PFL.
Ready to get into it?
Yeah.
All right. Go. We're going team by team.
I would be very careful about slings.
Am I going to get sued?
Are you going legal on this?
Let's send you out on the right note. PFF sucks. Have a great day, everybody.
Boom. Wow.
Welcome into the PFF NFL podcast. Steve Palazzolo, Sam Monson, and happy draft day to everyone out there.
We made it.
We made it to the draft. It's tonight. It's live right here on this YouTube channel. Just tune in at 7:30. We'll be here 7:30, 7:45, getting ready for the draft. We'll be live tonight. You, me, Trevor, Chris, breaking down all the round one picks. And then you and I are going to stick around, work a little overtime, and go live. PFF NFL podcast starts live right after round one.
Deep overtime into the early hours.
So today, it's always exciting leading up to the draft, and I'm excited.
People in the booth as well, not just us.
Yeah, they'll be working solo. Yeah, they'll be there. They're not just going to press record and leave. Yeah, they'll be here. They'll all be working hard with us, and we'll have food to eat as well, as we broke down yesterday.
Hopefully,
presumably. So that's tonight. We'll be back here breaking it all down. But for now, we've got a great show for you. We've got Nate Tice from The Athletic. And we've got Bruce Feldman from The Athletic. Two separate interviews. We're going to throw it to them in just a minute. Back to back, talking to Nate, talking to Bruce. Nate, of course, bringing his Drake May takes to balance out a lot of the hate that Drake May is getting.
Yep.
And then Bruce Feldman always has great stories and what he's looking for the draft. We'll break it all down here in just a few moments. But first, as a busy parent, you want to give your kids a head start in their financial future. But investing can often be both confusing and time-consuming. So Fabric by Gerber Life makes it easy for you to set up an investment account for your child that grows with them and helps prepare for their financial future. Fabric by Gerber Life was designed by parents for parents to make it easy to plan for and manage your family's financial path. So with a UGMA account from Fabric, you can start investing in your child's future today. UGMA stands for Uniform Gifts to Minors Act. While your kids can't invest while they're minors, a UGMA account allows you to invest on their behalf and gives their investments more time to grow. So to join the thousands of parents who trust Fabric to help protect their family, start investing in your child today at meetfabric.com/PFFNFL. That's meetfabric.com/PFFNFL. meetfabric.com/PFFNFL. Portfolios managed by Ford Washington Investment Advisors, Inc. Additional services provided by Apex Clearing Corporation. All investing is subject to risk. Monthly minimum contribution required. Learn more at meetfabric.com. All right, let's get to it. We've got Nate Tice, and then immediately followed by Bruce Feldman. All right, we are thrilled to be joined once again by Nate Tice of The Athletic. Nate, welcome back, man.
Thanks for having me. I'm very excited if we get to do one of the things that I think only intrigues us three, and doing some player comparisons. Starting, I like to knock one off per decade with all these, like with comparisons. maybe a guy from the 80s, maybe a guy from the 90s, but I know I'm in great company when I get to do so. So thanks for having me back on, guys.
Of course. I always love hearing your player comps, so we're going to get into that in a minute. But the most important reason you're here is to balance out the Drake May hate. So let's talk quarterbacks high level. Give me your take on the quarterback class as a whole. And then let's get into where you stand with Drake May. I think he's been your QB1 for quite a while here.
Yeah, it's been a 1A, 1B with May and Caleb Williams since last May when I watched these guys. And just getting my four or five games for getting my feelings on them, I kind of was aware of both of them. Obviously, Caleb Williams won the Heisman and all that, and USC, and I was watching other guys on that team. But then with May, I was watching Josh Downs, the slot receiver, and I was like, who the hell is this guy? And I started kind of like looking around, like, okay, other people think this guy's pretty good. All right, I'm going to really dive into him. And since last May and watching him progress last season and then watching him this season, there's just been nothing to sway me off of that or to sway me off of Caleb Williams being still viewed as an elite guy. Like, these guys were 1-2 for everybody, it seemed like, going into the season. And I just haven't balked at either of it. I think if you watch the film on these guys, even if there has been some quote-unquote regression, that's situation regressing, not them. I actually think they showed growth in both of their games, especially with May. But the whole question, and I do the show with Dane Brugler for The Athletic, is who's QB3? Who's going to bounce up there? There's a lot of people we all like, but who's going to bounce up there? That was always the discussion. And right. Still, to me, is that there's a gap between May Williams, and then the rest of the guys. That's how I view this class, and I think those two are special. I'm really excited about both of them to enter the NFL, and I just have more question marks about the other guys, Daniels, McCarthy, and the other funky bunch group that you want to get into on day two. But with May, it's he does what the elite guys do. He's aggressive. He can create. He mitigates sacks. He makes his teammates better. He pushes the ball. He is willing to take the highs and high lows and do it constantly. He's able to create with his legs and his arm, and he's got good size. He's 225 right now. He's super young, you know, just turning 21, redshirt sophomore. They won games as a redshirt freshman, and I've seen him bring his team back single-handedly. He's getting no help, and I just watch it, and I thought, actually, this whole process was others would start watching him, even this quote-unquote bad games, North Carolina State, Clemson, and everything. There's so much positive stuff in those games that it's kind of weirded me out that people are acting like those are just abominations. I watch him, I'm seeing him just carry the team, scrambling, right, handling protections and mental stuff that's very advanced for such a young guy. I thought others would join this bandwagon, and I look around and I feel like the John Travolta meme in Pulp Fiction, where I'm just like looking around, I'm like, where's everybody at? Because there's just so much that I like and so much to like, and I think his floor is way higher than people are making out to be. They're acting like he's a total teardown project. And I think he's actually pretty advanced with some of his stuff. You know, of course, there's mechanical stuff to clean up. But I think, again, that's stuff you can clean up because he's such a good athlete. And he already shows glimpses of doing it. And Derek Klassen, I'll just leave it with this, is had a good line. He goes, if we're worried about footwork and you're saying that's his big negative and he's doing this with, quote unquote, mechanical issues, which I don't think he has that other people are making it out to be. Holy crap. Shouldn't we be really excited? but it seems it's gone the other way where people are like, yep. Big project, big risk, and I just see it opposite than that.
It feels like it's definitely the overcorrection, I think, is getting out of control, like instead of taking on a life of its own. But I do think that you kind of described certainly the timeline correctly, which was like a year ago was those two guys, and we didn't really know which one was going to be number one, 1 and 1A. And then whether it was actually last year's tape, or I think probably more likely once people that aren't college football guys got to the process, right? That's when we started to see the adjustment. And to me, anyway, when I got into those guys, Caleb Williams and Drake May, thinking from the narrative they were on the same level, 1-1A, it became pretty quickly, okay, Caleb Williams is number one, and now I have more concerns over Drake May, and I think there's a gap there. And then it became Drake May versus the other guys. But it seemed like when everyone got to that point, they then couldn't stop the ball rolling down the hill. It's like, no, we got to keep tearing away at him. But I agree with you. I think it's going way too far at this point. Like this idea that he's a complete and total project is kind of crazy. But how do you address or sort of deal with the inconsistency? Because that was the big thing to me. Yeah. It's like, why are we missing so many just routine throws? Like Kurt Warner called them the layups, right? Like, for why is a guy this talented missing so many layups? What's the problem there, and why do you not see it as a big enough or as big a concern as other people?
One is volume. We see more May throws than the other guys. So when he's going to just naturally have more misses. If I have more at-bats, I'm going to have more strikeouts. I think a little bit, too. That was for Steve. But I think a little bit, too, is that some of the bad, he does have bad misses where it comes with sprays because he's a line drive thrower. And so some of those, if he misses, he misses hard. Herbert has the same problem where if he misses, it's like the one miss of the drive goes 10 yards wide. It happened at his pro day as well. Even if I thought that the pro day was overwhelmingly good, he had one throw that hit the freaking wall. But then the next five throws were boom, boom, boom on the money. He misses hard. I think this offense was horrid. I think this offense, as far as timing, as far as details, as far as options for the quarterback, and why I want to bring that up is that it was all operating on finding space for the receiver and the quarterback. Nothing is tied together. And that's where I'm seeing a huge disconnect with some of these guys that play quarterback, and I do respect their opinion. They're grading them like they're grading the next day after they're the quarterback coach grading them the next day. And so, of course, it's like, oh, he's a step late on here, but it's like, that's the offense. This is not a West Coast offense, an offense that's 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, hitch, ball out. 1, 2, it's drift into space, find it. Okay, he found space too. He adjusted on his route, now rip the throw, which is, I think, for how deep they're asking him to throw the ball, that's incredibly hard to do because there's just so much room for error. So I do think he has footwork stuff to clean up. I've already seen improvement from last year to this year. He kind of had the issue. Baker Mayfield has this issue still. Drift back in the pocket, like in Madden, where they just keep drifting back, yeah. drifting back. I think he cleaned that up a lot this year. He still has it once in a while, but I think that's one thing that there has been progression. But I think all the footwork stuff has been overblown. Not to say it's not clean, but I'm not saying it's a thing that's not fixable. I think it's very fixable, and I think I already see plenty of glimpses of him operating on time with good eyes. So that's why I'm optimistic about it and think it's cleaned up. I just think he got in an offense that's a little loosey-goosey, and he was just operating in that offense.
Yeah, Sam and I talk about this all the time. I think a lot of people see the same stuff, right? And they describe it in similar ways. And then it comes down to how do you value those things? I feel like we saw that last year with Anthony Richardson. I think a lot of the descriptions of Anthony Richardson's play were similar. And then you say, this is a good thing. This is a bad thing. This is a first round. You know, this is top of the first. This is top five. So same thing with Drake May. Like, you're acknowledging a lot of the same stuff that Chris Sims, who we had on the show, who has Drake May as QB6. JT O'Sullivan, who we've had, you know, those guys don't love Drake May. They're kind of taken aback by missing the layups. Kurt Warner. But now where do you weigh those things? And I'm kind of with you, Nate. I thought people would see this and the recency bias of like a Josh Allen would be in their head. Not that this is a Josh Allen arm talent or comp or anything, but Josh Allen cleaned up the layups, cleaned up a lot of the footwork, cleaned up a lot of the stuff from Wyoming. I thought people would go down that path and be like, man, this guy is 21, redshirt sophomore. All we have to do is clean up, you know, hitting a swing pass or a hitch and some footwork. That's fine. Give me that guy. But instead, they're like, what you're saying, man, sit this guy for a year. We can't, you know, he can't see the field.
Yeah, well, that's the thing with the sitting for a year thing that I'm kind of pulling my hair out a little bit, is that it's underrating May's mental side. I think he's advanced. I think this offense is not going to ask him to do all the other things that these guys want. Like, of course, he's not going to look like in a John Gruden 50-word offense where he's making checks and has to drop back perfectly 5 steps or 7 steps on something. And I think that's knocking a guy for doing what they're asked to do, which I think is strange to me.
Can you describe, you posted a play a couple weeks ago, sorry to interrupt, but the NC State game when he checked
quote unquote his worst game, by the way.
Yeah, his worst game. But you had that play where he read the blitz, checked to a sprint out, made a great throw.
Yeah. So sprint outs can be a blitz beating play you can kill into, check into, depending on the offense. He doesn't look at the sideline, which tells me that they put this on him. You know, a lot of college offenses, the quarterback will look at the sideline to get the signal, all that stuff. That's what you're checking into. So he just looked at the defense and goes, oh, okay, I have something. Of course, this is part of the game plan. I'm not saying he just made this up and did it, but the fact that they put this on his plate is just an amazing sign. This is like what you want. If a fourth-year guy did this, I'd be very excited. But the fact this is a redshirt sophomore doing this in an offense, again, that I didn't think was very advanced. He got there. NC State's shown a blitz. NC State either blitzed everybody or dropped 8 every play that game, which pretty translatable to the NFL sometimes, depending on your offense.
Vikings.
So he looks at it, adjusts it, moves the running back to the other side, which also shows more detail, showing that he understands that the back has to be in a certain spot. They do the protection. He sprints out left, throws behind, pins a guy for a touchdown, and a play that should have been blown up based on the coverage look originally. So again, you're seeing an advanced mental side on the road in a rivalry game when he's hurt and the rest of his team falling apart. And they're going to the red zone. He's doing all this on third down, all on his own. And again, that's where I have a huge disconnect from the people that have to sit. I'm saying ride this guy day one. And yeah, there's going to be some blemishes when he's too aggressive. But I think this guy needs the reps, and it's going to be exponential with every rep that he gets up. His growth will be because of the mental side he shows. And also that NC State game, they're getting their asses kicked on defense, and he just keeps coming back. And you see his competitive side. He's supposed to be a psycho competitor. So again, there's some intangible stuff here that I'm betting on. Everyone talks about the other intangible stuff, and usually when guys get hyped up for intangibles, that means what they're doing on field isn't good enough. May's intangibles as far as competitiveness and athleticism, as far as work ethic, all that stuff, that's why I'm like, just keep working with this. Like I don't want to disco stew this and say he's going to the moon, but he's still like, you know, this is good. These are the things you bet on. And that's, again, these are all calculated bets. So I don't think his bust percentage is as high as others do, but I think his starter and star position, potential is a little bit bigger than others do.
That's the other thing I was kind of surprised about, Nate, was that when people started to sour on May, I was thinking, is this an off-field thing? Is this a personality thing? I thought it might be because Justin Herbert got this like introvert tag, and not that it has mattered or anything, but guys get these labels. And then I'm hearing people, you know, friends in the industry and everything who don't love Drake May, and they're like, but he's a great kid. And I'm like, wow, like he's a great kid and shows all these things. I feel like with you, like that's what you bet on.
I invented the piano key necktie. That's I feel like I'm taking crazy pills with this because that's what it is. That when the season ended, and thankfully I do that show with Dane. So I have a good eye on most of these guys. I'm watching them throughout the season. I'm not saying I'm deep studying them because the NFL season's happening,
right.
But it's, you know, I'm watching them on all 22, two, three, four games during the season. And then in January I sit down and I'm like, okay, I'm going to watch them all in a row. And so like in middle of January, end of January, Senior Bowl time, I was like, I kind of was good film wise on these guys. So for me, it was like, all right, as long as I'm not hearing that they are like, you know, assholes off the field, or they have competitive issues, or they're not hard workers. In fact, I heard everything the opposite. Actually, all these guys have pretty good reviews from what I've heard. All four guys, I should say, the guys that are talked about in the first round. But I've heard just made psycho competitive, hard worker. Reminds me of Andrew Luck. What other things did I hear? All these just amazing things. He's the youngest son of this super athletic family. It's a super competitive family. All these things. I'm just, what happened? What games got played? Did two games happen that I don't have access to? So again, there's just a disconnect right now. We're all going to come up with our own individual opinions on this. But the fact that people are just going, no, he's six. I wouldn't touch him. I think he has to sit. That's where I think I have a big disconnect, more than me having him 1A to Caleb's 1B. I understand that's a little different, but the fact that people are going, no, I wouldn't even touch him, that's where I think is a little weird.
How much of the he needs to sit idea do you think is, you know, we've got some throwing or some mechanical issues that we need to clean up, and you basically can't do that in the season anymore? I mean, certain coaches will come out there and say, we don't even touch a guy's mechanics in season. Like we this is game plan oriented. Mm-hmm. Like the first we're going to touch his mechanics is the next year again, right? So if you're playing a guy during that, you're playing him with the bad mechanics and potentially entrenching bad habits or whatever. Like if you were, number one, do you even agree that he has those mechanical issues that need to be fixed? But if he does, is that a problem if you're then playing him for a season with the bad mechanics, knowing you probably can't touch them until the following year? Because then you get the sort of Josh Allen progression, right? Where we might get a couple of years of really rough play before we can get the mechanical problem squared away. And suddenly you get this giant leap forward from Josh Allen. He becomes the current version.
I do think some of the mechanical stuff is overblown. I've never been, guys throw how they throw. Like, as far as, like, he got some knocks. We're going to talk about footwork in a sec. But as far as just even his throwing motion, I saw some people trying to knock it. Guys throw how they throw. Ball gets there on time. I could care less. They could throw it underhand.
Yep.
And I'm fine. That thing, the throwing motion gets overblown so much by people. And by 100%. People, I should just say, draft Twitter.
Yeah.
Draft X.
Whatever. They don't know what they're – nobody knows what they're looking for. Like, nobody knows. Don't even get me started. Yeah.
Yeah. Quarterback guy I've ever been around does not give a shit about that. So I'm going to trust the Paul Chris and the Sean Paytons of the world more than and the North Turners of the world. I'm
footwork
sorry.
Is
I'm
going to
have
though.
Faith
I
in what
that.
They say.
Yeah.
But the footwork is where you usually see the mechanical improvement happen. That's where Josh Allen improved more than anything. Right. He was a big overstrider, and they really cleaned up his footwork. Much has been written about it, with the work he's done with Jordan Palmer and all that. I see 80% of the time the footwork's fine. It's just once in a while he'll feel late, and then he'll overstride, and that's where the sales come. That to me comes more comfort mentally. Guys usually overstride as a quarterback because they feel late on a throw. Oh shit, I didn't see that guy come up, and I gotta really juice this ball in there, so they really overstride, and that's where the accuracy the sprays come. May that has that issue. So where I think accuracy improvement happens is the mental side improves, their feet calm down, and has the trickle-down effect that now I can anticipate and throw before and give myself room for error. So again, this comes back into, and I totally get what you're saying, Sam. It's like, okay, we're not going to really work on his mechanics and everything, but technically they are, because they're going to be working on the mental stuff.
Right.
They're going to be working on, hey, we're doing this type of drop back with this timing. So that's why, again, I don't have as many concerns about all this. And so I know it's a nice idea. Oh, we're going to sit him, or we're going to clean him up, just like Mahomes and just like all these things. Depends on the team that drafts him, and depends on like the circumstances. The guys that usually could sit went on to a really good team. Mahomes, I'm trying to just even think. Josh Allen, they tried to sit, but that was because they had nobody there, and then they ended up playing him. Dante Culpepper would be another one I was around. Guess what? They had an extra first-round pick that year, and they were just coming off a 15-1 season. That's why they were able to let him sit. Carson Palmer sat his rookie year. They had Kitna on the roster, and then it was just, you know, that was the Bengals. I mean, we know how the Bengals were in the early aughts, so I think no one was really paying attention to that. But I think he needs reps in a good way. It's a great question, and it is something that I think gets overblown, and I think some of his stuff will come mentally and footwork-wise, which I think happens with game reps as opposed to me just working with him in an open field. So,
right.
Again, coming back to just get him on the field and let him go.
I'm glad we got our Drake May balancing act out there. So we appreciate that part of it, Nate. Now, we had you on a couple years ago. We didn't do it last year, but a couple years ago, we had a full player comp show. I do want to go back and read some of those, because Sam and I came prepared for those. We're not prepared this time around. We're just going to get your player comps. But a couple years ago, we had comps like Kenny Pickett, Sam. You had as a better John Kitna.
These are all mine?
Yours and Nate's and some of mine. In the spreadsheet,
I just as good ones.
Yeah, I don't see a label. I just see names.
I think that's you on the left there.
Okay,
I that's my mean one.
Because I see my Mike Wallace, Will Fuller. Yours was kind of mean. You had Taylor Heineke.
Yeah,
and now look at them.
Pretty good about now.
It's turned out pretty good.
We had Jameson Williams, where I have an annual Mike Wallace / Will Fuller comp. And last year it was Jameson Williams. That year it was Jameson Williams for me. But you, Nate, had Bob Hayes. For Jameson Williams.
Wow.
Yes. Yeah. I played to the crowd here.
Yeah, that's right. So
wait, can I
knew I had like an old school one for him, and I can't remember which one it was. That's right.
Can I take a victory lap over Malik Willis?
Yes.
Okay, that was Cordell Stewart, another player that can't play quarterback. It's perfect.
Cordell had way more starts than Malik Willis. He actually got it.
Yeah, until they determined what was self-evident, that he can't play quarterback.
Last one I want to highlight where we all did well, Tyler Linderbaum, the center that eventually went to the Ravens. Sam, you had athletic Jeff Saturday. Right. I had Jason Kelsey, and Nate had Jeff Christie. And
yeah.
All good, successful NFL centers. So that's what we're bringing to the table here with those types of comps. That's what we had from a couple of years ago.
Man, perfect.
What was Jeff Christie's arm length? He was a former fullback. So
check it.
I don't even know.
Check an arm length on it.
No way they even measured that back in the day.
So what do you have for this year, Nate? What players and what comps do you have for us this year?
I said this one, and someone tagged you, Sam, on it, so it might be the same one. Okay, Jeff Christie had 31.5-inch arm, so that Linderbaum one almost nailed it. I said Marvin Harrison Jr. reminds me of a bigger Devontae Smith, and someone tagged you. Did you have a similar one as well as Marvin Harrison Jr. and a big Devontae Smith? If you didn't, then I'm totally claiming it.
I might have mentioned that on the podcast at some point, but it's certainly not with enough strength that I remember saying it.
Okay. I did a cut up of him like with the ball in his hands, and I was like, this moves like somebody.
Yeah.
And it was bigger Devontae Smith is what I came up with. But my old school comp for Marvin Harrison Jr. is Art Monk.
Good. Art Monk.
And I went back, watched some film on him. They're similar size, and I watched it. I watched some YouTube on him, and I feel even better about it. Art Monk.
Marvin Harrison Jr. also feels like you have to ask the question, what if Marvin Harrison Sr. had been 6'3"?
That's it. Like, I mean, they move exactly the same. Yes. It's so scary. It's so scary, man.
Yeah. Bigger Devontae Smith. We're writing these down for next year when we check these again.
Like it's obvious, but like, you know.
That's good.
What if Marvin Harrison Sr. had a 6'4" son?
Yeah.
Oh.
What if we took this Hall of Famer and simply stretched him a little bit?
See, it doesn't work for Joey Porter and Joey Porter Jr. playing different positions, but it does work.
He plays corner like Joey Porter Sr. That's right. So actually kind of,
I do love that. No, that's good. That's good.
So clean.
I love that you're also grinding Art Monk tape to make sure.
I had to, because it was like, there's somebody that, like, it's not, I'm not going to lie, I could tell you, I remember two clips of Art Monk in my entire life. So it was one of those, but I was like, there's somebody that this is. And then that was the one I threw out there, was Art Monk. This one, I can say, I for sure, like, know the comparison. So I feel really good. This is Ladd McConkey with Emmanuel Sanders. Huh. Ladd McConkey with Emmanuel Sanders, more of a undersized Z, decent sized Z. They're about 6 foot, but can play a little bit in the slot, but just a really good route runner on the outside. I would say Emmanuel had bigger or longer arms, but they're actually, their testing is very similar. Their size is very similar. Both very good route runners. That one I actually felt pretty good about how they both move.
Is Ladd getting too much of the, he's a slot guy?
Oh my God.
Type of narrative, right? He can play on the outside. He can run routes.
He can play on the outside. Yeah. He's, Dane and I talked about it. I looked at him as like a 65-35, mostly on the outside, can come on the inside, maybe on third downs and everything. Yep. But like on base downs, they only have two receivers out there. He can play Z and don't have to worry about it.
I'm with you there.
Everyone loves him. I'm not like preaching. I feel like I'm preaching to the choir with Ladd McConkey.
And like has played outside. It's not like we're talking about a guy who's in the SEC. The right. It's not like we're talking about somebody who is a slot receiver and now we're going, oh, can he play outside at the next level?
No, he's an outside guy. It's more, can he play slot?
Right.
I'm trying to figure out. I know. Brock Bowers was their slot receiver. Like, Ladd was the Z. So, another one. This was another 90s Vikings offensive lineman that I'm going with here. And rest in peace here. But it's J.C. Latham and Corey Stringer. For the Vikings, a former Ohio State right tackle passed away, but he was a 6'4", 6'5", right tackle, 350 pounds, just like J.C. Latham, could move well. I think could stay out of tackle. I really like Latham. He's my tackle three in this class, and I view him as like a top 12 guy. Just a mauler. That's a pretty good feat for his size and everything. I don't view him as a guard. I view him as a tackle, and I really like him. So J.C. Latham from Alabama.
Your one and
Corey Stringer.
Your one and two is Joe Alt and
Fashanu.
Right.
Because I just, the Fashanu stuff is, the Ohio State game is so bad that I think it's sticking out with a lot of people. My theory, and I haven't gotten on it, but I think that it's true, is that he was hurt during that game. He had a knee sleeve on during it. And that's made me a little more, okay, I would, this is one where I'm not with a team, so I don't really have the sources that I used to. Yeah. Where I'm like, hey, what's the injury medical stuff? What does that trainer say? But I can't get away from him. Even with the outlier hand size, I just really like what he is. Just the package. I think he's pretty good in the run. I know that's been kind of his knock, but I like him in the run game. But him and Ald, I think, are just very good. Very, very good. There's so many good offensive line prospects.
My take on Fashanu during... During Ohio State. I was just going with what he said. I feel like every time he got beaten, it was his fault. Like, just bad technique. He kind of rushed a little bit. Like, he didn't get overwhelmed, right? It's like, go against the best competition. Did you get overwhelmed? But I don't think he did. Right. I think he's incredible. If he's staying within his technique, I think he's one of the best pass protectors to come out in a long time.
Yeah, and I like his technique. I think he's kind of – and his eyes are really good.
Just
like,
a couple snaps, I'm saying. Yeah. A couple here and there where he was off.
I know. He's kind of gotten – like in the process, he's kind of been like the O-line version of May, where I'm like, people are going to watch all the games, but he's kind of just kept dropping. So I'm curious where he ends up.
I don't understand
still really like him.
All right, what else you got here,
Nate? What else I got? We'll go off the line. We'll go off the offensive line, because even though I have a couple more, I'll go Dallas Turner and Bruce Irvin.
Now that's
Dallas
an
Turner
one.
And Bruce Irvin, and that one I feel really good about. That's also the type of role I think Dallas Turner should play, as that 3-4 Sam, 3-4 Jack kind of player. Drops into coverage a little bit, rushes, good against the run, really long. I know Bruce had a really good year where he had like 15 sacks, but I think how he ended up was like a 6-8 sack type of guy. That's how I think Turner is going to be, like a 6-8 sack guy, but a really good player that plays every down. But maybe not the overwhelming sack guy. But that one I actually feel pretty good about, as far as like,
that's a good one.
How he looks, how he plays, everything. So that one I'm sticking with. Staying with the edges, Chop Robinson, Yannick Ngakoue, kind of come back to the well with this one a few times. Doesn't play the run that well. Very twitched up pass rusher. Maybe slightly undersized. More of like a super designated pass rusher type. So that's why I keep kind of telling people that really like Chop. It's Yannick went in the third. You know, that's why I'm a little hesitant on Chop maybe going top 20. Maybe, you know, I think his range is more late first, early second, but I do like him.
I used a similar designated pass rush type for him. I don't have comps for all these guys, but I used Carl Lawson for Chop Robinson as far as
that's another one.
Pass rush specialist, not great against the run, but a little bit better than Yannick, I would say, but similar.
Yeah, he's more twitched up than Yannick.
Yeah.
And Yannick might be a little bigger, but same iffiness against the run, call it.
I think
they're okay not playing the run. Yeah. Going back to maybe receivers here, Jalen Polk, who I really like from Washington, Robert Woods going with. That's the one, and maybe more of a play style thing, but their size and athleticism comps are actually pretty similar.
I like that.
But play style, dirty work, plays inside, outside, just very useful. Might not be that high end one. I don't think anyone thinks that, but I think a real good two and a good offense. I think you guys might like him as well, too. Do you guys like Polk?
Polk jumped out at me like right at the start. Again, like guys that I'd seen from somebody else's tape. So watching at the start of the season, because Trev, we did a similar thing with Trev, right? Yep. Where he would come on and give me guys to watch and we'd run it through the show. So watching Michael Penix Jr. tape, and I knew everyone was big on Roma Dunze. I was like, what about this guy? Jalen Polk's amazing.
I did the same thing with Dane. I go, hey, are the other receivers something? He goes, no, they're looked at. It was like day two guys. I was like, okay, good, because they're dunking on everybody.
Right.
it was like the five slam a jamma up there in Washington. Like, they were just,
I went into the receiver group, I expected to think that like Polk was going to be amazing and I'd be like, you know, I'd have him as like wide receiver five or something. And the more guys I watched, the more like, okay, number one, this receiver class is insane. They're all good. Yes. And number two, I don't like him quite that much. I still like him, just less than I thought I was going to when I started it.
I had some cold water on me too. I was like, do they have two future number ones on this offense? Yeah. And I'm watching. I'm like, okay, I know what you are.
Right.
You're good number. Basically, what he was in college.
Yeah.
I think he translates. That's the thing that was awesome with those Washington guys. What they do, the receivers, that translates, because they got asked to run like a real route tree, do some screen stuff. They had to block. They had to line up in the slot and outside. I like all three of them. Like, I'm super high.
Dang.
Roma Dunze, rich man's Chris Godwin. That's my comp for him.
Really?
Daniel Jeremiah said Larry Fitzgerald, and I said rich man's Chris Godwin. I'm like, they're on the same spectrum of receiver. So he's somewhere in between those two, I feel like. But I love Ndunze. I love Jalen Polk, and I love Jalen McMillan. They're all – I think I had Polk as I have a second-round grade on him, and McMillan, I have like an early third on him. And Ndunze is my receiver too.
I have to pitch this comp to you because I just remembered it. Our guy Vic Trojai does our injury report stuff. He gave me a comp for Roma Ndunze, which was Herman Moore.
Oh,
there we go. Back to the 90s.
Yeah,
that's good.
How big was Herman? I actually don't know, but I saw him.
He was pretty big.
A lot of balls. 6'1", 6'2",
but thick.
6'4".
No, he was big.
He wasn't that big.
6'4",
218.
Right. Herman was a big.
That is a phenomenal one,
isn't it?
Now I want to go watch more '95 Lions when him and Perryman were going off
just
with Scott
catch
Mitchell.
After catch after catch.
Barry.
Oh. Man, that's a really good one.
Herman had 123 catches that year, I want to say. 95?
95.
It was
like
the juice ball. It was like the juice ball era.
95.
They had like a juice.
Yeah.
It was like NHL goals and catches for NFL receivers.
Yes.
And then baseball caught up.
Yeah, 95 was the year where like every receiver went off with an insane number.
Everybody was over 100 that year.
It was only the NFC Central. It was Herman Moore and Chris Carter. A couple more. I don't know. Do I have any more receivers? No, receivers kind of – no more receivers there. But Leia Tulatu, edge. I said Diet Coke, Trey Hendrickson. I couldn't find like a perfect one for him, but that's why I went with Diet Coke, Trey Hendrickson. Flat. Christian Haynes going offensive line, UConn. Really like him. I have a second-round grade on him. Shaq Mason, who's guard with the Texans right now. But
for Christian,
I like Haynes a
for
lot.
Christian Haynes,
yeah, yeah, okay. With Shaq Mason, they're kind of similar size. He might be a slightly taller, but good athletes and everything. I'm really, really high in Haynes. I
like Haynes too.
I tested well, did really well at the Senior Bowl. It was kind of all he checked the box. It's like, all right, if you dominate this level play, all right, what's and started this many games, how do you do when you go against the other guys? And he tested like a really good athlete. It's kind of, all right, good. That's all I need to see. You know, like, I don't know what else he has to show. He has plenty of long arms and everything. But, yeah, that's another guy.
How do you view those top edge rushers, this group? Because we've been saying Latu is the best player. Turner's the best athlete versus like the best composite of the three. And, you know, that's kind of where we are effectively.
That's a good way to put it. Turner, I think, is going to be the most useful of the players, but not the one that gets the most sacks. Kind of already touched on it, because I just think skill set, age, he has more room to grow. And also, he's already a pretty good floor for what he is. I would not take him in the top 10, having said that, but I do like him. He's my number one. And then I kind of look at Verse and Latu as the same tier. Latu, I get it. He can get after the passer, and he has advanced pass rush moves. It's kind of like that's, it's easy to project him. It's like, no matter what, he's going to have a role somewhere because he has a skill that's valued. But then Verse, if I'm the Saints or the Jags, or not, I'm not saying they're drafting this, but those types of defenses that want to push the pocket and everything, I really like Verse. If you need a good number two who's good against the run, he, again, not going to be a sack guy, a high-end sack guy, but just a very useful guy. Might not be a Pro Bowler, but maybe a step below that. That's how, where I like Verse, like where I'm on a good team, but already had, like the Texans to me, if they didn't do what they did this offseason, like with Daniil, they were perfect for Verse for me. So like pairing with Will Anderson, I kind of like that, but then they went higher than Verse with Daniil Hunter. But yeah, I like all of them, but I don't love them. There's not one edge guy I truly love in this class. I'm even just looking through it. I'm trying to, like, I like Braylon Trice, but then I'm realistic about what he is. Like, I look at him as a round three guy.
Yeah.
Yeah. You know, he's not athletic enough. He's not big enough, but I like his play style and everything. But that's the thing. There's not one of those guys that seems like a freak. I'm trying to think how I want to end this. I have two more. Yeah, I have two more.
Perfect.
Is this even good content? Me just listing off
this comments. I love like it. This is great. Our people love it too. They're going to love it.
Okay, good. Malik Mustafa from Wake Forest. My safety one. Not saying that's high praise in this class, but poor man's Buda Baker. Going with a lot of poor man's, if he knows.
Yeah.
Poor man's Buda Baker. I really like Mustafa. Really good tackler. He tested actually fairly well. He's just short, but he's like stout for his size. You know, he's like 210 at his height. And I actually think he's better in coverage than I was expecting. I thought he'd be a little stiff. I like him. I think he's a good player. I think he's going to be a fine starter in this league. If someone takes him on day two, it looks like I'm very high on him compared to the consensus. But yeah, Malik Mustafa, a little Buda Baker there.
And then the last one has him at 140 as of record time right now. But he's been as high as 64. So
that's where he is. Okay, yeah. I think I have him like 50 on my big board, but he's safety one at 50.
Yeah, the safety class, like there's, you know, it's not a great group. So yeah, that
it's
makes not, sense.
That's the flavor you want. That's really it is. The last one, save best for last. I went with the quarterback here, and I went with Caleb Williams, and I went with one that I've already shared on Twitter. But that's Drew Brees when he was coming up Purdue.
That's right.
That's the one, and that was one where I was smelling colors. Like I had just finished writing the entire day, and I'm like, I think this dude reminds me of Drew Brees. I might just be going nuts. And I went back, did the same thing, watched YouTube stuff of him, Purdue, lighting up the Wisconsin, going against Ohio State. I was like, there it is, done. Tweet, going with this, put it in the article, finishing the article, done. But that I've really come to it, especially because people remember Drew Brees now or at the end of his career and being kind of a nickel and dimer, check down artist, very accurate and everything. Caleb's accuracy has been underrated. He is extremely accurate. I even underrated him going into this year and then watching this throughout the year. And then finally, when I sat down and studied all the games, I'm like, this guy has excellent accuracy. And the quick throwing motion, his footwork is very clean when he gets to do traditional dropback stuff, just 1, 2, 3, hitch and go. And then when you watch Brees, it's like, that's Brees back in college, even. Brees had a little more wild man to him than people realize, and was a much better athlete than people realize. So same size and everything, too. So, yeah, Caleb Williams, Drew Brees. I don't think that – who else have it? Art Monk, Hall of Famer, I think. Manuel Sanders, Pro Bowler. Yeah, pretty lofty praise for some of these guys. Drew Brees, just a future Hall of Fame quarterback I'm comparing Caleb Williams to.
This draft class has a few Hall of Famers, a rich man's Chris Godwin, a Diet Coke Trey Hendrickson, a poor man's Buda Baker. It's got it all.
Got it all.
I love
got it.
It
all.
Comps are always fun. So, yeah, we appreciate
they
it.
Are.
That's great.
They are. I'm sure no one will take these and use them in bad faith ever.
Caleb Williams will be an immediate Hall of Famer because you just said Drew Brees.
To That's be it. Fair, the other players that he's being regularly comped to are Mahomes and Aaron Rodgers. So it's not like might as well go with a different Hall of Famer.
Why do you hate Caleb Williams so much?
I'll never compare someone to Mahomes, ever. And you'll never get it out of me. It's like Favre a little bit.
Yeah.
Like, it's like they're 1-of-1. Like, I've never really seen someone play like Favre. Even Mahomes got compared to Favre, and it's like, no.
Oh, and they're used. They're used every year. They're, well, they're two of the most common ones.
Yeah, well, it's because whenever anybody is playing like so wildly outside of structure, there is only two or three guys that made it work. So you have to comp them to one of those guys. Because otherwise you're comping it to just some terrible player that's the reason he couldn't work in the NFL.
I went with a Jane Daniels, Rich Gannon comp because of some of the size stuff and everybody. Yeah. And that was one where even Dane was like, really? Like, he was like, really? You're gonna go with Rich Gannon? Yeah, people are gonna go, oh, totally, Nate. Yeah, totally. That's exactly who he plays like. Yeah. But that's, you have to, when you go to some of these outliers, you kind of have to scrape the barrel. Yeah, I guess he runs around like this. Some the Randall Cunningham comps that gets thrown out every year.
Yeah.
Like Jane Daniels got compared to Randall Cunningham. And I was like, come on, guys. Another guy that's like, you can't compare anyone to Randall Cunningham.
He got sacked on a quarter of his dropbacks his second year in the NFL. Literally also, a quarter of his dropbacks. Never seen anything like it. Never heard of anything like it.
There's also two completely different Randall Cunninghams in the NFL. Like, two different players Minnesota exist within his career.
Some of his highlights, this is just total aside, but we're fine here. It was some of the highlights, like the Moss Thanksgiving game. A couple of those throws, Randall wasn't supposed to be throwing those. He was
just throwing clear out to Moss.
Whatever. Even ones that were like simple. It's the one like kind of catch and run on the sideline where he kind of outraces everybody on that Thanksgiving game. It's like he's throwing like a hitch against cover two. Like, it's like the worst thing you could ever do. And it turns into a highlight that we share for years and years and years.
I love it. Well, Nate, as always, we appreciate it. Thanks for the Drake May love and comps, and tell everybody where they can find all your stuff and what you're doing throughout the draft.
First and foremost, Twitter, X, Nate_Tice, find me there. Slowing down with some of the film right now, which is kind of nice. But you also find us, the Athletic Football Show. We have a draft show gonna be live Thursday, Friday in Detroit with Dane Brugler, Robert Mays, and then you also can find my writings at Yahoo. I don't know what I'm doing this week, probably a mock draft, let's be honest. It's probably I don't know what I'm doing. We're doing mock draft. Get the clicks.
What else would you do?
But thanks, guys.
Well, we always appreciate having you. Always love seeing you when we're out there on the circuit, at the Super Bowl and the whole thing. So thanks for coming on again. And we'll talk again soon.
Thank you, sir.
Thanks for having me. Thanks, guys. Thanks for having me.
All right. We are thrilled to be joined by Bruce Feldman of The Athletic. Of course, I don't know if you're most famous for the Freaks List, but currently that is a big part of what you do, Bruce. But again, thanks for joining us again.
I am most famous for that, and I can live with that. And thanks for having me.
Yeah. It's draft time. You mostly cover college football, but I love the insight that you bring during draft time because you've covered all of these guys. Are there any, starting with the quarterbacks in particular, any high-level quarterback stories that you're following? Like, after watching these guys for multiple years, what are you looking at as far as, say, the quarterback breakdown heading into the draft?
I'm most fascinated by Michael Penix Jr. and what ends up happening in the draft process. He's a guy, even going back to his days at Indiana, was around and then covered him quite a bit at Washington. And I've written a lot about him and talked to a lot of people about him. And he is no doubt a polarizing subject if you look at draft Twitter. And I get some of that, but I think the guy who turned out to be the most polarizing of the quarterbacks when I talked to actually coaches who played him wasn't Penix, it was actually Drake May. But with Penix, I would say this, one of the, as you mentioned, the mock draft I do, really what I think is unique about it is I'm taking it, the analysis almost all from the coaches who played them and scouted them and game planned for them and then what they saw. So it's a really, they actually know, it's not like they're like, oh, we think they were doing this against, no, these guys know exactly what they were getting into and trying to do. And one of their coaches I talked to last year as a defensive coordinator, who was the most effusive of anybody I spoke to about CJ Stroud, thought he was clearly the best quarterback in the draft, thought he would, if everything worked out in terms of fit, thought he would hit the ground running and have a big splash in the NFL, which obviously he did. And that guy said, seen a lot of Caleb, seen a lot of Penix, said, if you want arm talent guy, it's Penix. He's clearly the difference. He was like, you know, there's some stuff that we thought we could do with him, but he was like, that guy is really, really special, really, really talented. And so I'm very fascinated to see, in part because of a lot of the guy quarterbacks who turn out, you know, get in the draft, who don't work out. If you talk to people, Daniel Jeremiah most notably, about this, like the reason why they often bust or to get disappointments is because they can't handle the adversity that eventually comes and hits them in the NFL. Penix had to face real adversity with all the injuries he had, was very candid about it, faced it, you know, was rattled by it, and it really evolved and grew and turned out to be, you know, arguably the best quarterback in college football last year. And I think that bodes well for him in the NFL when, you know, he has to deal with more adversity.
Yeah, it's kind of interesting. Caleb Williams just had a thing, you know, fighting back against this idea that he'd never face adversity. And the adversity that he was sort of citing is he pulled a hamstring once and lost a few games his final year in college. It's like, it doesn't feel like that much adversity to me. He's certainly not relative to somebody like Michael Penix Jr.
Yeah, and yeah, the thing you're talking about, I think, was from a Greg McElroy interview.
Right.
And I saw that. And, you know, adversity is kind of in the eye of the beholder, certainly. You know, Caleb was a guy who came out of the QB collective, you know, camps and was touted and anointed as the most talented guy. And he, you know, overtook Spencer Rattler at OU, obviously, when Rattler struggled. And then he was, you know, jumped in the portal and went to USC and did really well in his first year, when obviously won the Heisman, you know. But you see the pictures of, you know, the fancy apartment he lived in, and he's traveling all over the world and designer clothes and everything like that. It's not to say that he doesn't work hard or any of that, but you know, the adversity, I think, in terms of from the Penix side of it, again, I'm not saying that they're arguing about this at all, but I'm just saying I know what he was dealing with to some degree, because he was very candid in talking about it. Some of the other guys, it's like, you know, I think they know, I think they feel like, okay, I had to deal with this, and I'm sure it wasn't fun or there's challenges to it, but that's probably not the level of adversity that may be waiting for them in the NFL. You know, I did this big story on Penix about 2 months ago, and one of the people I talked to was EJ Manuel, really bright guy who played, you know, was a first round pick. We talked about the adversity, and it was injuries with him, and it got him off track, and he never really was able to get back on track from that. And I think that is a good window into what can happen. You know, it's not just injuries. It could be all sorts of things. We saw the Sam Darnold Monday night, I'm seeing ghosts clip. You know, he's never been able to get back on track. And I just think it's a gray area for a lot of people. But then once they get there, and everybody, you're the franchise quarterback, especially at that position, you're the franchise guy, how do you respond, and can you get out of it?
Are you surprised at all after covering college football so closely, obviously, but surprised by J.J. McCarthy's rise at as far as, you know, the NFL loving him as maybe a top two or three pick?
As a top 10 pick, no. Maybe as, you know, going in front of a couple of these other guys potentially. A little, but not a lot, just because I know what the people inside Michigan felt about him, you know, and how football smart he is, how competitive he is, what a great leader he is. The other thing is, and I've seen some of this comparison on social media in the last couple of weeks about like he's kind of like Kirk Cousins, because NFL teams think he will be a plug and play because of the system. He's a, you know, Kirk Cousins has obviously been a very good NFL quarterback and is making a ton of money. He's a way better athlete than Kirk Cousins. Like, I would put that out there. Kirk Cousins is probably a 4.9 guy who wasn't dynamic with his legs. JJ can really move.
Oh, yeah.
And you'd see that whenever they really needed it. 3rd and 8, and he would have to go create something. You see some stuff on film where there's definitely some wow stuff in there. I don't think people give his athleticism enough credit. I think this is not... you know, the quarterback who was before him, you know, Cade McNamara, who transferred to Iowa, who I think had, you know, was a solid college quarterback and could do some of the stuff with the footwork that Jim Harbaugh was going to demand. This guy is a, you know, has a really good arm in terms of throwing the ball on the move and can extend plays and create stuff. So I'm not shocked. I mean, he also just turned 21. I mean, he's still a guy that I think is still physically growing. I think there's a lot to like there. I'm not shocked that some NFL people are meeting with him and getting kind of really impressed by him.
Yeah, I mean, it's funny. If he ends up going 2 overall, which is looking like a bigger, like a much more high chance than it was at the start of this whole thing, when Harbaugh came out and said, like, he should be the top quarterback in this draft, it was seen as ridiculous. And now he might be the second guy after Caleb Williams, who's the consensus. Take me back. What was the genesis of the freak list? How did that all come about? How did you decide to make that your baby?
Yeah, so this is back in the 2003 or 4 era, and I'm myself and Buster Olney, who at the time was ESPN's baseball writer, they both ESPN told us they wanted us to do blogs year-round. And as you guys know, there's way more of a hot stove league, and baseball has a longer season than college football. So I was looking for stuff to write in the off season, and I had always been very interested in the freak guy that, you know, not every program, but a lot of programs had, where it was just the guy the coaches and some of the players would be wowed by, whether it was like a big, heavy guy who could, you know, a 320-pound guy who could do backflips, or some 170-pound guy who could bench press 400 pounds, or a guy who could throw the ball 80 yards. There were those guys you'd hear like little rumblings about. And so that's how the story started. And it was a top 10 list. And one of the guys I had talked to was one of my ESPN colleagues who was doing some MAC games. He goes, there's a linebacker in Miami, Ohio. There's insane stories about him. His name is Turner Nande. He's from, you know, originally from Nigeria. He was like a 520-pound bench guy. He was, you know, a 4.4 40 guy. You know, it would probably have been a great bobsledder, you know, in terms of those kinds of things. And he, you know, was drafted by the Titans. I think he played, you know, maybe in a game or two, and then bounced up to the CFL. But he was that first guy. And there was other guys in there, you know, Calvin Johnson, Adrian Peterson was in the first couple of years. And it just grew. It went from 10 to probably 30 or 20. And then now it's 100 plus. And I have FCS guys and D2 and D3 guys and NAIA guys, because when I became a sideline reporter for Fox, I don't know, 7 or 8, 9 years ago, before the games, I would hear from a lot of NFL scouts who'd be on the field in warmups, and they would ask me about the freaks list, and it was very flattering and humbling. But then I also realized, wait, these guys could be great resources, because they're seeing some of these people that nobody who does what I do in terms of covering college football is really aware or paying attention to what, like, the Jim Nagys of the world are doing year-round and studying. And that opened up a whole nother world for the freaks list.
Do you now get guys like petitioning you with their, you know, workout numbers and bench press records and 40 times and stuff? Or is your DMs just full of like 19-year-olds from Division II, you know, showing their three cones?
Watch me jump out of a pool. Watch this.
It's not full of them, but there are definitely some, you know, and there's a handful of guys. Then you try to, you know, you got to see what's verifiable, what's not real. And over time, you learn which coaches, especially strength coaches or guys, are like, okay, that guy told me this guy or these two guys were going to do this, and then they went to the combine and they did it.
Right.
You know, like, so it's definitely an interesting process, because like anything else as a reporter, you're really kind of evaluating how credible the people who are telling you a certain story, right? Like, I think I referenced this a little bit ago about the CJ Stroud, Michael Penix coordinator guy I trust his opinion a lot. I'm not saying I don't trust most coaches' opinions, because I think their level of expertise and what they're doing is very good. But there are certainly guys, and where I can think of is I remember a coach who I talked to before the Pat Mahomes draft, who was not a believer in Patrick Mahomes at all. Now maybe that guy would have been proven a little more right if Patrick Mahomes didn't go to the Chiefs and Andy Reid. You know, and it's just like, you're constantly, not everybody's always, you know, not everybody, even if they really know what they're doing, is going to be right all the time, you know? So, but when it comes to the players, you're like, okay, is this totally believable or not? And usually the guys who come out and reach out to you, they're sending some video of something they did or something that's like, oh, I probably got to ask this coaches about this guy. And that definitely happened. There's a small school player who has ended up with the Seahawks and is definitely, you know, I remember reaching out to Kyle Duggar because he was at the same school as Duggar and he was younger, and Duggar was a freaks list guy. He might have been my first small school guy I had on there. And Duggar was like, no, you know, he backed him up and started kind of telling me stuff. And I was like, okay, I'm on the right track with this one.
Well, I'm glad you do this during the offseason, because the college, I don't think people realize the college football offseason is the longest in all of sports. And 90% of it is about realignment and big money schools and things that is just nothing to do with the game. So I appreciate you actually, you know, talking about football players at some point during the offseason. You want to talk Marvin Harrison Jr.?
Yeah, Sam, that's the part I love. I mean, the business stuff, I kind of roll my eyes. Like, my podcast host is all in on that stuff, yeah. And it's good. And I know a lot of it matters too. But I love the football stuff. That's like the one thing that's never changed. I mean, I'm watching UFL games. I'm going to watch whatever I just love the sport for that. And so this feels more like that. I'm not saying Freaks List is exactly like a football Saturday, but we're talking about players. We're talking about what they can do and
get you going for the season. It's right up there with like college football magazines, right? Phil Steele comes out, Freaks List comes out. It's awesome for looking forward.
Thank you. Yeah. I had to push it back a little bit once the portal happened. I feel like I'm okay to say this now, but like I remembered once ridiculously freaky cornerback at UTSA, who obviously people know who that is now, putting up numbers that are blowing my mind when I'm told it by the head coach. He was like, when are you guys running this? And I was like, I told him. And I could tell the reason why is if other big schools or bigger schools find out about this guy, they're going to try to swoop in. But it's like once we put it out, I think in early August, it's kind of too late.
Too late to go get Tariq Woolen. Too late to go get him.
That's great. I wanted to ask about Marvin Harrison Jr. He's a guy that was right up towards the top of your freaks list. And yet now, as we get closer to the draft, it sort of feels like he's not being given credit for that part of his game. We're focusing on Neighbors and his speed and everything he brings to the table. We're focusing on the athleticism of Odunze. And it's like Harrison's seen as the safe guy that's just a good technician and a really good receiver prospect. Why do you think he's not being given credit for like how freaky an athlete he is?
Because he didn't run and test, and it's like the recency bias, you know. Like, I think we all knew Malik Neighbors was crazy fast. Like, he was a freaks list guy for me, I think, for 2 years. I know he was this year. But when you watch him run, you're like, whoa. It's just like, you know, I could see, you know, him doing the Deion thing where he runs into the, you know, like, all right, I'm done.
Right.
You know, like, you film, now you watch this. With Marvin Harrison Jr., you know, he was a guy on the GPS who was clocked at 23 miles per hour. I think the question with him, and I had this in my mock draft, one of the coaches in the Big Ten I spoke to was like, this is an older coach, and he loves him as a player, but he goes, how come he didn't run? And I was like, well, you know, I don't think he had to run or whatever, but he was like, I think he's closer to a 4.5 guy than a 4.35 guy. Now, technically, I guess he could be, I'm not the great with math, but I guess he could be a 4.44 guy and still be closer to 4.5 than 4.35. And that's still moving plenty fast, especially if you're 6'3", 210. You know, he's super strong. He was not just good at everything. He's really, really, really good at everything. And he's a big receiver who was physical, who's really polished, really well coached. Everybody raves about him. You spend 20 minutes with him and you become easily like, oh, I really like that kid. He's super mature. And, you know, there's nothing I think you could find fault with Marvin Harrison Jr. The only thing, you know, anybody could ever say that would probably be a knock on him is that he didn't beat Michigan. It's not his fault. He almost beat Georgia
until
for a national title game, played three quarters of dominating them before, you know, whether it was a targeting or not. I mean, he's an awesome player. I think he and Odunze are the closest thing I would say to can't miss guys in this draft.
Interesting. You're saying Odunze. I mean, it is funny because sometimes the polished players, we talk about this with the Boses all the time. You used to hear, Joey Bosa's not going to get any better. It's like, well, he's a borderline all pro right now. How much more do you need? I mean, it's almost like, oh, give me Neighbors because I saw, like you said, the recency bias. I saw him run. I see the explosion. But our game numbers on Marvin Harrison Jr. are similar, right? We've got top speed numbers off player tracking and everything that are in the similar range. as Brian Thomas Jr. and some of the other guys that did run high 4.3s.
Yeah, whatever, yeah.
Yeah, so like we're seeing some of the same stuff. So I think if you know, end of the day, somebody's getting a really good player in Marvin Harrison Jr.
Yeah, if he slips past 6, I'd be shocked. If he I get it. There could be 3 or 4 quarterbacks in the first 5 picks, but after that, who are you? We did this on our podcast where my co-host was like, "Why do you have Brock Bowers going 10?" And he was like, "I think he's, you know, it's like 10 is really high. Like it's not right. like, and it's not like this is a great defensive crop of players right. in the draft, but." I just think there are guys, it's like, okay, what does a team need up there, right? You know, like how badly do you need it? I don't know. I just think Harrison is just I mean, if you ask me, would I take Ja'Marr Chase over him? I might have. But like there was nobody in last year's draft who was even in the neighborhood or even in the ballpark of him or Adunze or probably Neighbors, I think.
Yeah, completely agree. Chop Robinson, not necessarily getting a ton of love. The Penn State edge defender, maybe like a late first, early second type of guy. He was number 9 on the freaks list last year. Very good pass rusher. Is there a reason? Do you think he should be up closer to the top 15, or is that the right spot for him?
I think that's the right spot. I mean, I have him in my mock going, you know, second half of the first round, but in the first round. I mean, dazzling first step, you know, freaky athlete. I think what people wanted to see from the coaches I talked to is, does he have other moves? You know, he can beat you with speed, obviously, but then there's other stuff where Dallas Turner, who is right in that same realm of wow athlete, is shown to be more physical, has more of a repertoire, that and actually had much more production than Chop did. But I think potentially Chop could be a, you know, if he's a double digit sack guy, he's going to make a big impact. And I think he's a little bigger than people realize. People talk about him like he's 6'3", 240 pounds. I mean, he's almost 255. I think there's still a lot of growth there for him.
You mentioned kind of touch on this a little bit before, but how much do you weight or how do you kind of evaluate when coaches give you these kind of hyperbolic statements like, this is the fastest guy I've ever coached, or the strongest guy, or the toughest guy, or whatever? Like, obviously, when there's numbers to back it up, it's easy. But when these guys are just kind of going what sounds over the top on a prospect, how do you sort the wheat from the chaff and what's real and what's just, I love this guy that I've
just
got?
Just name
right now.
Names, Jim Harbaugh. You're talking about Harbaugh? Come on.
No, I wasn't who that was, where it's from, but yeah.
I'm just kidding.
Jim Harbaugh.
Sorry, go ahead, Bruce.
The biggest thing for me is like the track record. You know, you kind of know who has told you stuff, especially like, look, the Penn State guys, they have so many guys who have gone to Indy and lit it up and done either exactly what they had told me they were going to do or even exceeded it, you know? And it's a lot of dudes over the years, right? So I know, you know, it's interesting because like, there's a couple of Michigan guys who I think people are like, okay, I was expecting more. And then I go back to like DJ Turner last year. And one of the things they told me at Michigan the previous year, you know, he was a freaks list guy, was he ran like 4.30 from a 2-point stance, not like in a sprinter stance.
Right.
Right. And then he went to the combine and he ran, you know, he ran ridiculously fast, you know? So there is some of those things where it's like, you know, Aiden Hutchinson was exceptionally, like, I mean, he's obviously turned out to be a really good pick for the Lions. And so, you know, it's just, you're kind of going by the people who really know because they're around them all the time. It's not to say they're all going to, just because they test great, they're going to go into the NFL and turn out to, you know, blow up the league. I mean, I'm not necessarily saying that. I just think it's like, okay, what are the traits and how do they fit?
Do you have any other players off the top of your head where you were high on the freaks list, maybe didn't test as well, you know, like a Chris Braswell from Alabama, maybe didn't test as well as where he ranked on the freaks list and some of the other numbers that he had? Do you have a history, like a memory bank of some of those guys, or how would you explain some of those guys historically?
You know, there was one of the players who comes to mind, and it didn't end up because of the testing. It was because he blew a hamstring on his first 40. Kentavious Street.
Yeah.
You know, NC State had a good run at D-line, but he was the freakiest of all. And he just you know, I think he popped his hamstring on the first run because I was expecting, all right, he's going to tear it up here. And it was like, you know, kind of anticlimactic. I thought Olu from Penn State would have run a little faster than he did. I thought Kingsley, the big offensive tackle from BYU, because they raved about him in terms of, now he's still very athletic, but he didn't do what I think I heard he was going to do.
Well, he was one of those guys that there was a story in your freaks list where his offensive coordinator, I think, at BYU was saying he's Aaron the Robert. Most athletic and violent offensive lineman he'd ever coached. And, you know, that's a resume that includes guys like Garrett Bowles and Blake Freeland, who was like a genuinely one of the most athletic offensive tackles for years. So, yeah.
Or whatever Freeland did. Yeah. No
Kingsley Suamattia.
Yeah. And, again, I still think he, you know, can be a really good NFL player. He didn't blow it away like I think I was, you know, expecting him to. That was certainly one. I mean, the flip side, like the all-time guy for me, about, I don't know, maybe 15 years ago, there was a Estonian shot putter at SMU who was 6'8", 280, and like the numbers we had, people were like, there's no way this is possible. And then he went to the combine and did all that, you know, like it almost matched it exactly. And I think sometimes, especially when it's like a high level track athlete, I think people are like, that's what these guys do, you know, like in terms of like, they, I'm not saying they all they do is test and you know, do those kinds of workout numbers, but some of those guys, it's like, okay, I can see how it translates. Whereas the other guys, it's like, you know, their weight's fluctuating, what they're, you know, some of the other stuff they're working on. Because let's be honest, for when it comes to the combine, a lot of guys are training for these specific events for a long time, and it's maybe the first time they've trained for it.
Was that Margus Hunt? Was that guy's name?
That is Margus.
Margus Hunt. And well, he came a year or two after J.J. Watt, I believe, and so he had the size. Right, looked. It's like, oh, this is the next J.J. Watt because he's going to test crazy and he's got incredible size. I mean, he stuck around the league for a while. He just never became.
Walker, I think, yeah.
Yeah, he just never became an actual star, whatever it is.
He was a freak. He wasn't a great football player, right? I mean, that's like he was definitely deserved to be number one on the freaks list. You know, it's just like, but there are just some guys who are just look. Brock Bowers is a fantastic athlete. And he's been on the freaks list, but not like in the top 25. But he is not Kyle Pitts, you know, right. He's not, or Jimmy Graham, you know, right. He's not 6'6 and going to run 4'4 and broad jump, you know, 11 feet. He may broad jump 10'2 and he's 6'3 and a half or 6'4. He's just a great football player and he's a really, really good athlete.
Before we let you go, I want to touch on this story that you wrote recently entitled, "The best way to know what the NFL Combine is really like is by following Peter Schrager." And so we try to explain to our listeners a little bit about the NFL Combine generally and like what the week's like. It's not just the testing you see on TV, all the behind the scenes. We try to give a little bit of that insight. You gave a bunch of that and told the story through Peter Schrager and his kind of rise to, you know, the TV star that he is now.
Yeah, it was a idea I've had for a while, and then about a year ago I was like, you know, Schrager would be a good person to try to shadow for this because he's like the king schmoozer of all. And I didn't really think about it from you know, ground up, but the more I thought about it, because like he does not, you know, he went to a school that doesn't even have a football program. He went to Emory and he was freelance writing out of college because he was working as a PR guy for a hospital in New York. And so he really didn't have, you know, like he didn't have this journalism background. He kind of home cooked his way into really networking, and he's really good at that. I think that's a gift. And I wanted to see what it would be like because, you know, look, Steve, I see you. I almost know where I'm going to see you though. Like, right. You know, when I go up from the Spring Hill / Courtyard in those lobby and I see like PFF has a studio, and obviously you're 6'10, so you're going to stand out. But like, you know, at the Combine, the beauty of it, one of the things I love more than anything is to walk the sky bridges or in the halls, and it's like, who am I going to run into?
Yep.
You know, it's like, because you know, for most people, that's 75% of the connections you're reconnecting with people. Yeah, there'll be people you're going to say, hey, I'm going to go meet you at Starbucks, or I'm going to go out to dinner or lunch, but it's mostly that. Well, Schrager, you know, as I was thinking about this, I'm like, man, he might be now the most trusted insider in the NFL. Now, I'm not saying he's breaking as much as, Adam Schefter or Tom Pelissero, Ian Rappaport or Garofolo. But he's going to dinner with these guys where he's sitting next to Andy Reid at the Chiefs dinner. And he's, you know, going to dinner with Sean Payton. And obviously Sean McVay is now like BFFs. And I think because of how he works as somebody who's providing context for a lot of the NFL, not just more the transaction, but just the transactional stuff, I think they're probably comfortable telling him stuff or talking around him where they're probably more, might be more guarded around some of the other guys who are just, you know, really chasing scoops. And I'm not saying that's all they do, but I just think of that. And so what was really interesting is like, how do you get those connections in the first place? And there's a story, and you and I talked about this offline, about like they send, Fox is sending him to Mobile for the Senior Bowl. And it's like, you know, part of me thinks like Peter Schrager in Mobile feels a little like my cousin Vinny. You know, he's from New Jersey, and how's this going to work? And so he tells me the story of, I didn't know what I was going to do. I had like 4 days to kill. I knew I wasn't going to be like hanging out with 60-year-old NFL coaches. So he went online and all like looked at every team's coaching staff and looked for coaches who he'd heard good things about who were really young. And one of the ones he did, he just cold call email at, you know, S. McVay at like redskins.nfl. whatever it was. And Sean McVay agreed to meet him out for drinks. They hit it off. Now, like, you know, we flew somewhere as a family and there was no Wi-Fi, but we were able to hear all 10 episodes of the Flying Coach podcast with Peter Schrager and Sean McVay, who turned out to be a really big deal. And that was a good connection to make when he was just getting his foot in the door for both of them.
Yeah, it's funny. He said it was something about, you know, I was stalking Sean McVay in Mobile or whatever. And it's like, we've all done that. We've all been in Mobile. Like, oh, I want to, because you're always like either trying to meet somebody who's got more stature than you or whatever. But then you get to some level of stature where like people are trying to meet Bruce Feldman or people are trying to meet Sam. We ran into someone who was trying to meet Mike Renner last year. Really, really wanted to meet Mike Renner, our, you know, our former colleague here at PFF. So that's what Mobile's all about. So if you're trying to, you know, get into the business, just get to Mobile and find somebody to stalk.
I always thought, like, so for years I would go to the AFCA convention. It's the football coaches, and it's mostly college coaches. It's about 10,000 of them, it seems like. But it's also some high school coaches, junior college coaches. And when I used to go, I first went in 1999, and there were no other reporters there. And there were really no other reporters went probably for the first half dozen years I would go. After maybe the second, I remember I would write on my, this is in the day of paper boarding passes, you know, and I would write on it on the plane, here are the like 25 coaches I'm trying to run into. And maybe I would get to like 10, run into 10 of the 25. And then the next year it was like the same number. And then the third year I realized I'm not messing with that idea. All I'm going to do is meet the coaches who know the coaches I'm going to go drink with. Because at that point, if you know the, if the people you meet through the people you already got connected with, then it's almost like there's an inherent trust, because it's like, oh, this person vouches for this guy, even though we have an inherent skepticism of the media. If this coach thinks he's okay enough to drink a beer with or whatever, then you know, I'll take my chances or whatever. And then it just grows from there. And I just think it all comes back to networking. And look, I think, you know, I met a bunch of guys through you, you know, and you just, you know, whether Indy is great for that, because whatever the, you know, high velocity, that bar inside the JW, there's just tons of people that you just never know who you're going to run into. It's a small world. I mean, like, I ran into Harbaugh, who I know because obviously I covered him for a long time, but I was not expecting to just happenly run into him in one of the sky bridges and caught up with him for a little bit. It's just, you just don't know who you're going to reconnect with at what point. And that's what makes it, I think that's what makes it fun. Now, it's not fun if you have to like have deadlines to follow, or you guys have shows to do where you're like, oh, I want to be out there and now I'm tethered to this. But, you know, that's part of our jobs.
So everyone knows, you know, the combine records, the 40 time, all those kinds of things. But there are always these mythical athletic feats, like, you know, Bo Jackson supposedly running like a 4.1 40 back in the day. Yeah. What are the most ridiculous athletic feats or things that you've heard of, or at least in the verifiable range but aren't official?
Like combine wise or just in general?
Just anything. Any, you know, the most ridiculous athletic strength, speed things that you've come across down the years.
You know, from the one at the combine sticks out to me is Byron Jones from UConn, you know, like setting a world record in the broad jump where it's like just, you know, an insane feat of athleticism kind of thing. But then you get some other stuff where you're like, I remember I started posting video of the Turkish getup. I don't know if you guys have seen that, but like, so I had Michigan's old strength coach, Ben Herbert, who's now Harbaugh brought him with him to the Chargers. Would have it, just Google Turkish getup, but like 2 years ago, Wisconsin had a legit freak punter, Andy Vujanowski. I think I'm pronouncing it right. Sorry, Andy, if I'm not, but like he, you know, I don't know, 6'3", 230. And I guess he got wind of some, you know, people talking about the Turkish getup from the freaks list. And he went out and videoed it and he did it. I mean, this year we had Chris Jenkins, who's like, you know, Chris Jenkins' son, who's freak, who was like a top five freak, doing it. And to see it, just a massive man doing something like that, you're like, oh, I think I could do that, but not with weights. You know, it's just like, and most people probably couldn't, you know, it's crazy. But then you get certain things, like there's a rabbit hole you can go down on Instagram with like jumpers and professional dunkers. And so I have a buddy who lives not far from me, Dave Anderson, great guy, former Texan slot receiver who played at Colorado State. And we went out to lunch once, and Dave had been, I think, a pretty good basketball player back in the day. And we were talking about something, because he works in sports science field and sport performance science now. And so I was telling him there's a guy whose social media on Instagram is King Dak, D-A-C. And his name, I think, is Darius Clark, who is a jumper at Texas A&M. And if you watch some of the jumping stuff he does, it is insane to see. It's like he's floating on air. Like, it just keeps going and going and going. And you can go down this rabbit hole of guys who, and I don't know if any of them are very good in actual basketball, but the stuff they can do just from a jumping standpoint will blow your mind. And I remember I showed Dave, we were going to lunch, and I showed him this, and you could see his eyes is just watching this guy just levitate up and up, where it's like, and it's not technically the same vertical jump. It's like a three-step vertical jump, right, which is not the same as obviously what goes on in Indy. But these guys are like up around 50 inches now.
Wow.
And there's a massive difference between 50 inches and, like, you know, if you jump 40 at the combine, that's like wow stuff.
That's huge, yeah.
These guys are like almost 10 inches above that now.
So I might go down that rabbit hole now.
I could send you a bunch of, like, some of it is also now, like, you're just very curious on some of the stuff you're seeing. Like there was a walk-on receiver who played at University of Buffalo. You can watch this guy do not just box jumps, but they'll stack like 20 or 30 plates of 45 pounds where it's taller than him. And you're like, first of all, when he lands on this, how is he not, like, what are the outtakes of this where he's not knocking everything right over? The guy's also wearing like soccer shin guards, because I'm sure there's times he has missed and banged his shins into like something that would look really painful. So,
yeah, I've seen some of those Instagram videos, the box jump, the three-step box jump where they're jumping onto something, that those kind of soft boxes that actually have some compression.
Right.
But they're able to get to a spot that's taller than them and stick the landing, like a not clash back off.
There's another jumper, Isaiah Rivera. You know, that, like, some of these guys are pretty muscled up because I think they're doing a lot of squats and a lot of front squats and everything. But like you see, it's insane how what they can do. Now I would imagine some of them, like I said, the one receiver, the former receiver at Buffalo, and I don't know how much, if he played at all, you know, played much, but like just incredible what they've been able to do. And there's another, you know, there's like a profession after that for them about as professional dunkers or, you know, teaching, you know, there's a big rabbit hole you can go down. It's not a creepy one, at least since you're going on Instagram.
Bruce, tell us what else you have going on and any final storylines you're keeping an eye on as far as the draft leading up these last couple weeks.
Yeah, you know, I have, I think, one other draft story that'll run maybe the week of the draft from a more NFL coaches side of it. I have a story on a college quarterback who's still in college, who I think it'll be a fun story for people to read, that hopefully will be out within the next month. And for me, I'm really interested. There's a handful of guys that were not first round guys. I am fascinated to see what happens with Peyton Wilson, who was arguably the best defensive player in the country, but has a lot of medical questions, shoulder, knee, you know, ran incredibly well like 10 years ago or 15 years ago. If he didn't have the medical history, doing what he has on film, testing the way he did, you know, linebackers are looked at like almost like running backs in the draft now. But, you know, 15 years ago, I think he would have been a top 10 pick if he didn't have the medical history. I want to see where he goes. I want to see who gets Mike Sainer still, who was my favorite college player. I just thought Mikey's not big, but one of the best leaders and best playmakers and, you know, just made everything go. I mean, they were a great defense, the best team in the country. And, you know, he's not big, and you look at him, he looks like a law school student when you see him with his glasses walking around. But, you know, he's an exceptional athlete, and he's tough as heck, and he makes a ton of plays, and I think whoever gets him will end up being very happy about him, you know, whether he goes mid-second round or third round, I don't know.
Love it. Well, we appreciate the time as always, Bruce. Be sure to go check out Bruce over at The Athletic. Wait, you know, is the Freaks List coming out early August again?
Yeah, early August. Yeah, so okay. We have time for that.
We have time, so that'll be coming out soon, but keep an eye out for it. So again, thanks, Bruce. Appreciate it. Thanks for the time.
Thank you.
Always a pleasure. Thanks for having me, guys.
All right, special thanks to Nate Tyson, Bruce Feldman. Always love talking to those guys. We had some fun football discussions here over the last couple of weeks with some smart people leading up to the draft.
Yeah, and I think it's an interesting hearing that a bunch of smart people watching the same tape can come to wildly different opinions on a specific player. You know, that whole Drake May narrative, right? Everyone's seeing, generally speaking, the same thing. I do think Nate made a very good, compelling argument of how much of it is, number one, fixable, how much of it is also not his fault. You know, he's attributing a lot of those struggles to the system and to the offense. And as soon as you take him out of that offense, put him in a better system with better players, half of that goes away immediately before you even get to, can we fix some of the footwork? Can we fix some of the mechanical problems that whether they're there or not? Like, that is an argument I haven't heard too many people make, but is a pretty strong one.
That's the other interesting thing about the draft process, and I think I'm with Nate on that as well, where, you know, he's been doing this for a while. He's always pretty much liked Drake May. And then you just assume, okay, what's everyone going to think in January, February, March as the more teams, you know, their information comes out? What's the buzz going to be? And I'm with Nate. Like, I didn't predict that people wouldn't like Drake May maybe as much as they have, especially in part because did he have the worst situation of all the top four quarterbacks?
Right.
I mean, Caleb Williams didn't have a great situation, but he's got Lincoln Riley, he's got this historic play caller who's
an
putting guys
that works. And, right. You know,
you've got Jaden Daniels with two first round receivers.
Yeah.
You've got J.J. McCarthy with the national championship team.
Michael Penix Jr. with three elite receivers.
Yeah. And Bo Nix with, you know, two really good receivers, Troy Franklin and Johnson over there. So I think Drake May probably had the worst situation. And I do think evaluators over the last couple of years have leaned into that a little bit more, where they said, hey, you know, maybe the Bama QBs, they've got these great receivers. What about the guys that don't have that? And they've focused on that more. And it feels like they've forgotten that part of it, evaluators generally. They've forgotten the part of, hey, we'll clean up some of the easy stuff. We've got the special, right? It just felt like Drake May had all the ingredients that people would love rather than, you know, dismiss, and we're more in dismiss territory. But we'll see. We'll find out tonight just how true that is.
Yep.
Anyway, it's important to me that the supplements that I take are of the highest quality, and that's why for the last few years we've been drinking AG1 here on the PFF NFL podcast. Unlike many supplement brands, AG1 conducts relentless testing to set the standard for purity and potency. AG1 is constantly searching for how to do things better, 52 iterations of their formula and counting. Their team is always trying to find better ways to source, test, and aim to find the best quality ingredients available. It's researched and developed by an in-house team of scientists, doctors, nutritionists with decades of experience in their respective fields. So many people have asked me if AG1's actually the real deal, and they are. There's a reason why we've been drinking it for so long. So, quality for AG1 isn't just a buzzword. It's a commitment backed by expert-led scientific research, high-quality ingredients, industry-leading manufacturing, and rigorous testing. At each step of the process, AG1 goes above and beyond industry standards. So we've partnered with AG1 for so long because they make such a high quality product that we genuinely look forward to drinking every single day. So if you want to replace your multivitamin and more, start with AG1. Try AG1 and get a free one-year supply of vitamin D3 plus K2 and five free AG1 travel packs with your first subscription at drinkag1.com/PFF. That's drinkag1.com/PFF. Go check it out right now. All right, special thanks again to Nate Tice and to Bruce Feldman. Happy draft day, everybody. You and I are going to be back here in just a few hours. Just a few hours, and so will you. Make sure you're with us tonight live for round one and then live right after round one. I don't care where you are during round one. When you're done, though, you get here and join us live for the PFF NFL podcast. So happy draft day, everybody. We'll see you again a little bit later. PFF NFL podcast.